I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli. I write for The New York Times, The New Yorker, The Village Voice, Newsday.
I'm Terry Teachout, drama critic of The Wall Street Journal.
And I'm Peter Marks, theater critic of The Washington Post. Welcome to episode 11 of Three on the Isle, a twice-monthly podcast from New York about theater in America. We are hosted by American Theater Magazine, a publication of the Theater Communications Group. Well, Elizabeth and Terry, welcome to episode 11. We're going to make this an all-panelist edition of the show this week.
You mean there's nobody waiting in the hall?
Correct. We're not going to have anybody else in this little tiny studio except for Kirby Pate, our intrepid producer, who's sitting by us at all times listening to all the imperfections and ironing them out. Thank God for Terry, for Kirby, and Terry,
and
Elizabeth.
Yeah.
So and for me, thank God for me. Anyway, we're going to start today with a discussion that Terry suggested, and when we introduce the segment particularly, I'll let him expound on this, but it's really pegged to the idea that's very pertinent today, which is the question of why some revivals work so well when they come back to us again, and why some fall flat in their second or third viewing after years of dormancy.
After that, we've all been taking a look at our calendars, our press releases, a general survey of what's going on, not just in New York, but around the nation. And we thought we'd spend some time talking about shows and companies out of town that we are either going to see or wish we could see, and suggest that you consider seeing as well, if you've got the money.
Or if you're already there.
Right. Yes, even better.
That's you know, let's not forget, we're national. Yes, and another thing we're going to do is we're going to catch up with the latest developments and the careers of some of our previous guests on the podcast, and that would be namely the playwright Lauren Gunderson, most produced playwright in America, and the director Laila Norgeborg, who probably is the busiest director right now. I don't know when she sleeps. It's incredible.
She's the hot kid, as Elmore Leonard puts it.
She really is. And of course, we're gonna go over some of the shows we've liked, and the Broadway season is really very, very active right now. So there's a lot to talk about, but we're gonna try to keep it short.
And also, Elizabeth is going to introduce a new segment, which is listener email. Mail. I don't think we get letters.
If you feel like
yes,
but we don't actually have a physical address.
Does anybody wear a hat?
No. Okay, so emails. The email bag.
We're going to answer some listener emails. So it's a jam-packed show. But first up, this was a subject that I think is really relevant, given the fact that in succession, anyway, in New York at the moment, we've got The Iceman Cometh back on Broadway. We have Angels in America back on Broadway. We have St. Joan back on Broadway. We have a jam-packed festival, if you will, of revivals. And the show, though, that sparked the idea of this conversation about the efficacy of a show coming back really was Terry's thought about one show in particular that really was a huge hit the first time it appeared in, what year was
1980?
It?
1980.
80. I mean, that's a long time ago, 37 years ago, 38? Children of a Lesser God, that's come back in a completely lackluster production to many of our eyes and ears.
Yeah, but nobody seems to care for it. And it's not just the production. It's maybe not even primarily the production, is the play itself. And I remember very well what the response to this play was in 1980, and then when it was filmed 7 years later. It was the sort of show that everybody talked about. And now the only thing that everybody is talking about is what a bore it is. And I was quite struck by that and quite interested in that. Because the subject matter, which is, of course, deaf culture, the show is about a speech therapist who meets and falls in love with and marries a deaf woman who does not speak. The subject matter is still very much up. It's still very much salient. The kind of thing that you expect when you revive a play like this is going to keep it afloat. Whereas Angels in America, which we've all seen and have been talking about for the last couple of podcasts, is already accepted as a period piece, a history play about something that happened a long time ago, and the world is very different now. Yet nobody seems to question the continuing vitality and excitement of Angels, the continuing relevancy of it. And children, nobody seems to buy that at all. And I've thought about that writing a review. Part of the problem is that children is just a little too dramatically creaky to survive its own transformation into a period piece. And that's inevitable when a play deals with something that is topical. It is going to become a period piece. But there's more to it than that. When this play first opened, most people, unless you knew somebody who was deaf, or obviously unless you were deaf yourself, they had no idea about its subject matter, about the world that it was portraying. It's an exterior portrayal. It is the portrayal of a hearing person, of a deaf person, of deaf culture seen from the outside. It's hearing-splaining, in a sense, if you want to use that current...
Oh, that's right. Good. Hearing-splaining.
Yeah. And back then, that was enough. But today, we expect something different. I think we want to start where Children of a Lesser God ends.
Oh, that's interesting.
We want to step inside the deaf culture at whose existence the play hints, instead of just looking at it through a window. And I think that that's the problem.
We should also point out that it was a huge movie hit as well.
Yes, a very big hit.
It won Phyllis Frehlich an Oscar, did it not?
No, that was Marlene Matlin.
That's right. Phyllis Frehlich won
a
Tony.
In the play.
Right.
Yes.
It's still a fabulous vehicle for a deaf actor. No question about that.
Well, this one stars, we should just say, the Broadway version directed by Kenny Leon stars Joshua Jackson in the part that John Rubinstein originally played on Broadway, and Lauren Ridloff.
She's wonderful.
Has never acted professionally before starring last summer.
She's
completely wonderful.
But why does it feel so flat to us, this piece?
Well, actually, I think there's two things. I think, as Terry said, I think there's problems with the play itself. The earring-splaining is very obvious. Like, for instance, the fact that the male lead, everything is filtered through him. So he always repeats what he says, even when he's alone with his wife and he doesn't have to. This is all for the benefit of the audience. It's a very clunky dramatic device. But I think also the production is so clunky. The use of the music is such a cheeseball. And I got to say, but I'm not sure that Joshua Jackson pulled it off.
Oh, no. I don't think so.
There were real problems in that performance. It was completely one note.
And what do you think, though, Elizabeth, you know, this idea that Terry sort of elucidates about a period piece, you know, what is the difference between a period piece and a classic? Why doesn't Children of the Lesser God belong in the classic mode that we think of when something comes becomes part of the canon, so to speak?
Because it's not good enough. When you get right down to the nut cutting, it's just not good enough.
Also, our understanding and the deaf culture has really changed since then. I think Angels in America was a lot on point with the politics of the time. So it actually anticipated a lot of the changes. So the times have caught up with Angels in America, whereas the times have left Children of a Lesser God behind.
Right. We now have companies like Deaf West Theater doing exactly the sort of thing we're talking about that we want to see, doing it in a way that seems absolutely contemporary, that comes from inside the deaf culture.
You know what's going to be interesting is when The Boys in the Band comes.
Right.
Because that is coming very soon.
Yeah.
I love that play. And I really do.
And judging by the last production I saw, which was The Transport Group a few years ago, that play still works.
Absolutely.
It will be a period piece.
Yeah.
It should be.
That was a great production.
Will it still be dramatically alive?
I saw a play a few years ago at Arena Stage called Trouble in Mind by Alice Childress.
One of the plays I have most wanted to review.
Now, that play was set in the 50s in a it was written in the 50s, set in a rehearsal room of a play. Alice Childress was an African-American playwright writing a play about a guy writing a white playwright writing a play about the South and with black characters in a kind of patronizing way. And the play really is about the appropriation of black culture and the fact that some of the black actors, there's white actors in the play too, resent what they're doing and others go along with it. It's fascinatingly complex. And it really feels like, to me, it's like a play that's waiting, as Terry mentioned, to come back to us. Yet it's not either a period piece nor a classic in that sense. And I wonder if, you know, is that different from my sense of that? Is that different from Children of a Lesser God, which, as Terry said, you feel like it leaves off in its time and we want to see something that follows it. But do we come back to it at some point and that happens to that play too, that it becomes a marker for this breakthrough moment in deaf culture?
You know, in the end, it all depends on quality, because I'll tell you another obvious reference point here is A Raisin in the Sun. A Raisin in the Sun is without question a period piece. Its issues are over. They're dead. But the play itself is completely alive as a dramatic entity.
Well, are you saying that racism is dead?
No,
is
but I mean the action of the play in the 50s, that period is now closed.
You mean the segregation?
I don't know, because I think the idea of white flight and it doesn't feel gone at all.
But what I mean though is that it doesn't require any connection with the present moment for the play to still be alive.
Oh, right. Okay.
Because
yeah.
it's about a human dilemma that is portrayed in a totally convincing and alive way. The dilemma is the dilemma inside the characters themselves. And I just don't feel this with Children. It doesn't come alive in that way.
I think it might work with a better production. I think it could. That production is not working on any level for on the female performance.
Yeah. But that, to me, brings up the other aspect of this that I wonder about, which is, you know, do we make these assumptions or draw these conclusions until an artist shows us why we're wrong about these things?
Oh, yes,
either
yes.
an actor or a director.
Absolutely.
And brings
it's
it back
possible.
In a form that you go, oh my God, I was wrong about this.
I think Boys in the Band is a case in point, because for years and years and years, it was deemed to be completely homophobic.
Right.
And now we've come full circle on that one, where there's actually a wonderful, I don't know if you've watched it, there's a wonderful documentary about the making of the play and the movie.
Right.
It's completely great.
I think that play is going to explode off the stage.
Wow. Absolutely.
People are going
I agree.
To, their jaws will drop and they'll say, where has this been?
The writing is ferocious.
It is ferocious, but it's also, you know, it's sort of in one key.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I just read it again recently, and it's so devastating what these people say about these men say about each other and about themselves, that it's almost relentless in that sense.
Oh, it's really, it's nasty, but
you can't superimpose present values on past experience. You can't say these men should have been more liberated.
Oh,
more
we're not saying that at all.
Oh, saying that, but the objections to the play that we've been hearing for the last 15 or 20 years have run in that way. Mm-hmm. And I was prepared to accept that as possible until I saw the Transport Group's production, which was an environmental production done in an immersive penthouse.
Yeah,
set.
In a loft, yeah.
And it was like you talk about that well-worn phrase, in your face. They were completely in your face at every moment, and their passion and their anger and their desperation, and you sell these people and people like them short if you think that they should have known better in 1968.
I was going to also mention, along these lines, an even older play that I saw at the Kennedy Center, again, astonished me. It was The Guardsman, which was originally done by Lunt and Fontanne.
Right, that's such a good play.
It is. Well, Molnar is one of those, you know. I mean, he's represented on Broadway in Carousel, which is based on Lilium. He's a wonderful playwright. But I saw a production. I thought it was going to be this, you know, old-fashioned sort of, Viennese sort of drama that I was going to, you know, check out of in the first act. And I was absorbed. It was slightly rewritten, I think, by Richard Nelson. I may be wrong. But anyway, it was directed by Gregory Mosher, and it was superb.
Yeah.
It was, you know, it felt like how could anything feel more topical than this play of deception, you know, that was going on in front of me? Not even, I don't mean like, you know, because of politically or timely, just felt like the emotions felt like they were happening right now. And that's the kind of thing, I guess, you know, that we critics either decide on the basis of that this is, you know, a jewel that waiting to be rediscovered, or, you know, something that belongs on the crap heap. And, you know, that's why I'm fascinated by the fact, and it's totally surprised me, that Children of a Lesser God really sort of did not measure up.
It's why I admire companies like the Mint Theater Company, which is an off-Broadway company in New York that specializes in rediscovering and reviving really forgotten plays by writers who are only known by specialists or who are considered strictly historical figures like Galsworthy or John Van Druten. Their track record is uncanny. They have a power to see this dead play on the page and realize, no, it's not dead. It's just waiting for us.
Well, I think we're overlapping a bit into an older segment on a podcast. You know, like, why do we have to see this again?
Yeah. Right,
which
exactly.
Actually someone brought up in the mailbag. So I think we can go back to that better.
And let's be sure to.
Yeah.
Now let's turn our attention elsewhere, even though.
I do think that we have to now wait for Ivo van Hove's production of Children of a Lesser God. No, I'm kidding.
I'll tell you what. You wait for that.
And let's just wait.
I'll go out and get dinner. Anyway, to turn our attention elsewhere, even though all three of us live in New York, we're very much aware of the fact that this is a big country and that there are important shows and productions to be seen from coast to coast. We review them as often as we can. I do a fair amount of traveling in the normal course of things. And we thought it might interest you this time around to hear about some upcoming shows and companies that have piqued our own interest. I'll start. I try whenever I can to hit one or two summer theater festivals every year. And one of the festivals to which I return most regularly, although festival really isn't quite the right word for a classical company that performs from June through November, is American Players Theater. It's located in Spring Green, a beautiful little Wisconsin village not too far from Madison. Architecture buffs know Spring Green is the site of Taliesin, which is Frank Lloyd Wright's home. And APT is headquartered on a hill that's just a stone's throw from Taliesin. That means it's a destination theater. You go there, as I like to do, to sit down for a week or so and to see several of the 9 shows that it presents every season in its 2 houses. One of them is a 1,000-seat outdoor amphitheater, newly renovated at the top of a wooded hill. The other is a 200-seat indoor house that opened in 2009. It's one of the most beautiful and functional pieces of theatrical architecture to open in this country since I've been a drama critic. Many of APT's actors, directors, and designers come from the Chicago area, but the company ranges more widely afield. Eric Tucker of Bedlam did Pericles there last summer. Hmm. This year, they're doing 2 Shakespeares, As You Like It and Measure for Measure. George Farquhar's The Recruiting Officer, a classic Irish comedy from 1706 that I don't remember the last time it was staged in New York. Mm. Heartbreak House, plus a new play about Shaw by John Morogiello, and 4 modern plays, Ionesco's Exit the King, Athol Fugard's Blood Knot, Timberlake Wurtenbaker's Our Country's Good, and Garson Kanin's Born Yesterday. The directors are people like James Bonin, William Brown, Ron O.J. Parsons, all familiar names if you see theater in Chicago. That is quite a package.
Hugely ambitious.
Yeah. But this is standard for them. I've been out to Spring Green maybe 10 times, and that experience has led me to consider it to be the best classical theater festival anywhere in America.
Wow.
That's a high card to play, but I'll stand on it. And I commend it to everybody's attention. If you're anywhere near Chicago or Wisconsin, it's reasonably easy to get to, and it's worth the trip.
Wow. I would, I'd go on a junket with you. I mean, I'd pay, but I mean, I would go on a Terry Teachout trip to see this company.
And visit Taliesin while you're there. That is absolutely part of the deal as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, I'll pick it up from there and talk about a few things that one that I will definitely see and 2 that I would like to see. I got to put in a plug for a Washington production, and that would be this musical version of the movie Dave, which is a very charming movie that starred Kevin Klein and Sigourney Weaver in the 90s, I think it was.
Yeah.
It was about a guy who's the lookalike for a president who's incapacitated.
That's I'd forgotten about that.
It's a charming piece, and they're doing it with it's the world premiere at Arena Stage with music by Tom Kitt, lyrics by Nell Benjamin, and Tina Landau is directing, and Drew Gehling, who was the love interest in Waitress, is playing the Dreamboat in Waitress, is playing the Dreamboat in, you know, in Dave. I think that sounds, it starts in July 13th.
That's a serious bunch of people.
Yes,
yeah,
it is.
That's a really
and this
good
is the
team.
Place that spawned, this is the summer slot that spawned Dear Evan Hansen. So it's got, they've suddenly got some traction in the sort of the tryout mode there. It's produced by Warner Brothers and other people. So they're in the, they're trying to, you know, really get into a high gear musical production. The other two I was going to mention briefly were ones at the, I went off, I'd love to go out to the West Coast and see this. Oregon Shakespeare Festival is doing a production of Oklahoma directed by Bill Rausch. The hook is it's going to be completely cast with women. So it's a completely female cast. I have no idea how that works. It'll be fascinating to see, I think. It's kind of wonderful in a weird way, similar to the Donna Summer musical on Broadway, which has a completely female ensemble, although there are some men in the
They
fill
do
in the
some
parts.
Of the supporting, but the ensemble is all female.
It's all
yes.
It's an interesting concept, and then that's going to be running all summer at Oregon Shakes. And then the other show that caught my attention is a play by Amanda Peet, the actress who's been doing plays all along. She's been writing and getting produced.
She had one at Manhattan Theater
she
Club.
She can really write.
Yeah, it's a really interesting and almost a little bit under the radar. Into even for you know, it's like her almost her writing career is eclipsing her acting career. Starting to she wrote a play called Our Very Own Carlin McCullough. It sounds like Carson McCullough, but it's Our Very Own Carlin McCullough. It's going to be at the Geffen Playhouse starting in June. And it's the story of a 10-year-old tennis prodigy and the battle over controlling her career as she becomes something major. And it just sounds to me, you know, it's a world premiere. Just sounded to me like something I'd like to see. And it's great that the Los Angeles audience will get to taste the show.
She was a superb actor, and she got started writing, as I recall this, because she just couldn't get interesting roles as she grew older.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, she was pretty frank about that. Yeah. We could do a whole segment one day about plays about tennis. There's so many of them.
Amen, yeah.
Or plays by actors, too. We could do a segment.
Yes.
Anyway.
Well, I'm going to talk about two festivals that I would love to go. I don't know if I'll have the chance, but I would love to go to. They're fairly well known, so it's more like a reminder that they're there and they're doing very good work. The first one is the Contemporary American Theater Festival in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, which seems to be emerging as a competitor to Humana in terms of
absolutely.
In terms of nurturing American playwrights.
That's what I'm hearing.
And it's early July. And I think they have six or seven plays.
Six
plays. There's a new play called The Cake by Becca Brunstetter, a playwright I really like. And she hasn't gotten a break yet. I've seen several of her
say
plays.
Say her name again, please.
Becca Brunstetter.
Okay.
And I've seen her plays off and off Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
I think she wasn't, they didn't do all that great. They did well, but not great. And of course, now she's writing for TV, which is, you know, more power to her. But I'd like to see her back on stage. And then there's an intriguing looking play called A Late Morning in America with Ronald Reagan by Michael Weller and with Tim Matheson as Ronald Reagan, which is completely weird casting. I mean, that just there, they have me. And then the other festival, a very established one, is, of course, the Williamstown Theater Festival in Williamstown in the Massachusetts in the Berkshires. And this year, again, is a very, very nice looking slate. There's a new play by Douglas Carter Bean called The Closet, which is based, actually, it's an adaptation of a French farce, a French movie farce. And it stars Matthew Broderick. There's a new musical
I'm
called
Lampica.
I'm interested
already. I mean, he really changed my feelings about him with the play that he did for Nathan Lane.
Oh, you mean
Bean.
Oh, Bean, yes.
Yeah. Whose name has just suddenly escaped me, but you know what I'm talking about.
The Nance.
The Nance, that's right.
The Nance.
All I can
think
of is the Nance.
I forgot about the Nance.
That was a good play.
I did not even look at my phone. There's a new musical called Lampica, based on the artist Tamara de Lampica, directed by Rachel Chafkin, did
the
Great Comet. And let's see what else. Oh, and of course, someone, a very familiar name that's going to bring us right to our next segment. Lila Neugebauer is directing The Member of the Wedding. Carson McCullough's, so she's going to be there.
I have never
intriguing.
Seen that stage.
I have.
Me neither. Oh,
yeah.
You just
yeah.
see Peter's
bring a
face.
Cot.
This is too good.
It was a snooze. It was a major snooze.
The play or the production? Or
I think it was
difference?
Both. Yeah. I think it's a very hard play to do.
Well, all our segments are so linked today. Look
yeah,
at that. Look
exactly.
at that. It does not
yeah.
age well. You know, it's like we planned it.
Like we were talking about before, sometimes plays are just waiting for somebody with the magic wand
right.
to touch them and say, hey, I'm a real play.
Right. It's possible. It really right. is possible.
Bring a polo.
Well, Lila is very, I mean, you know, she. I highly recommend our listeners, if you haven't heard that podcast, but we had her on one of our very early ones. I think maybe it was number two or three. And she's a very, very smart cookie. That Lila Neugebauer and
yeah
right was actually she's among the two we're going to talk about again because she has a very busy so we're catching up a bit with her. So it's just been announced recently that she's going to direct I think it's going to be a Broadway debut.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to direct Kenneth Lonergan the Waverly Gallery with Elaine May and Michael Cera, who's turned into the Kenneth Lonergan whisperer. He's wonderful.
Third play.
Yeah, third play.
Isn't this amazing
yes.
what has finally happened to Lonergan?
And Michael Cera.
Suddenly Broadway has figured out that this is one of America's major playwrights.
Right.
It took, what, 20 years?
Something
yeah,
like.
Ridiculous.
I mean, it's nice that it's finally happening. It's nice that it's happening with plays from, you know, 10 and 15 years ago.
And, well, they have not aged.
Right, right,
at least
right.
the first two we saw.
Love Hero is wonderful.
So,
it's too bad that it's not up for best play because I think it would, you know.
It's not up?
No, because I don't think it's up for best play. I think it has to be best revival.
Oh, I guess, right,
yeah, it
right.
Would be best
yeah.
revival.
But I was going to say something about your observation, and thank you for pointing out the Contemporary American Theater Festival, because I do think that they are. I went there last summer, and I was stunned at how good the productions are. One of their plays was marvelous. I loved it. It was one of the best plays of the year for me. Called The Niceties. I've talked about it on here. And another play that they did called Byhalium, Mississippi is going to be in the new season at the Kennedy Center. The first new play the Kennedy Center has produced in a lifetime. I can't remember the last time they did that. So hats off to you for
It's really great that we're having this incubator. I mean, the more the merrier. It's good. It's going to be interesting too because Les Waters is leaving the Humana Festival.
Right.
So they're going to have also someone new coming in, and who knows what's going to happen there. So it's very healthy. It's part of this. You know, it's just very healthy to have just more than one or two festivals nurturing American playwrights so then they can go on to write for TV.
And festivals, what a joy to go to them. I mean, the whole thing about a festival is that it's somewhere where you're not, and ideally you have to go to a certain amount of trouble to get there, and then you're there,
right.
and you spend a few days, and you're in the world, in the place of where the shows are happening. Maybe you can see two shows a day. There's nothing
but,
like
but
it.
But I also want to point out that it's great for people who live there. Like if you live in Louisville, it's wonderful. You can go through a whole, or wherever, you know, where in Williamstown or wherever you are. And it really, usually they also have a lot of local involvement. Like usually you have the local students working there.
Mm.
It's wonderful. I find it really incredibly healthy.
Yeah, Spring Green is like that too. I mean, you really feel that the roots of the theater are deep in the community, so much so that many people in the ensemble actually live there year-round, even though it's relatively isolated.
It also points out, you know, how these places that, you know, in the New York bubble, you have no sense of the life of the theater in a place that doesn't necessarily need New York at all. I mean, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, it matters greatly that Terry goes out to review. I think that puts them on the map in an important way. But the truth of the matter is these are places that are not supported by tourism per se. I think they're supported by the people who live in these places. I mean, they're supplemented
large,
by it. Right.
By and large. I mean, some of them are waiting to be discovered
right.
and to become true destination
right.
theaters like ABT.
Right.
Oregon Shakespeare is to a considerable degree
on the West
a
Coast.
Destination
right.
theater.
For that, mm-hmm. for that Pacific
because it's
rim.
Hard
right.
to get to.
Yes, right. right. Exactly.
So, so Terry, do you want to update us on what another of our former subjects has been up to, and that's Lauren Gunderson.
My pleasure. Lauren was our guest earlier this season. She has now won a very coveted prize, the Harold and Mimi Steinberg American Theater Critics Association New Play Award. It honors The Book of Will, her play about the posthumous publication of The First Folio, which was premiered at the Denver Center and which I saw and very much liked last summer at the Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival. This prize is given for scripts premiered outside New York City. It's the second time Lauren has won it. She also won in 2014 for I and You. And it's no empty honor because it comes with a check for $25,000. So nice work, Lauren, and congratulations from all of us on Three on the Isle.
And that leads me to a wonder about the same issue. You know, we took Broadway 20 years to discover that Kenneth Lonergan, he had to win an Oscar, basically, and suddenly he's on the map. What will it take for major companies in the next step up to understand that Lauren Gunderson is somebody, or do you think that's happening? On its own volition.
I can't say. I hope so. I mean, I've only seen one play of hers. I liked it enormously, and it made me want to see more such plays. But that's all I can tell you. Mm-hmm. I mean, the truth is, as we were saying just a moment ago, the real life of American theater is not in New York. It's not on Broadway.
Right.
It's completely decentralized. And that makes it hard for people like us to cover. It makes it hard to make general statements
right.
about American theater. Mm-hmm. And to move us to the something we're going to talk about in a moment, it makes it really hard to make sense out of the Pulitzer Prize for Drama. But nevertheless, that's the way things are. And we as drama critics have to grapple with it.
And that does lead us to at least something we should mention, although Martina Majok, I think that's how you say her last name, has not been a guest. We really should consider, I think, asking her if she would talk to us. Her play, Cost of Living, won the Pulitzer Prize this year for drama, surprising some people, I think, because it isn't a well-known play.
I don't believe any of us has seen it.
No, it did have a New York production. It was at the Manhattan Theater Club.
And it mm-hmm.
didn't. I somehow missed
it. The reviews were not stellar. Were they? Oh, yeah,
no,
Jesse Green liked it a lot.
No, they were good. Okay. The reviews were good.
Yeah. I saw a play of hers in development at the O'Neill Festival in Connecticut last summer. And she's a very talented writer, for sure. But it is fascinating, when you think about the and we should probably talk about this at some length
in
another show.
Somewhere down the line.
About
the
prizes
talk, yeah.
and how these people come to be selected.
We should have some jury member who will speak through an electronic distortion box.
Yeah, they're talking about myself. I have been the chairman of the Pulitzer jury numerous times for drama. And though there are some things you can't speak about, we can talk about the process. Not the individual deliberations, but we can talk about how this process works.
We'll come back to it, but I'm certainly eager to see this play or some other play by her.
And actually, I'm going to take us to our next segment, because which is the email bag. And one of the I don't want to say I was impressed, because that sounds like I'm surprised, but those letters were really, really interesting, and from all over the country.
That's really exciting.
Yes,
to
that's
me.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
So George Hanka wrote, and he was requesting, very, very nicely, a discussion about the state of American playwriting, which is a great idea. So I think we would be up. I mean, we're not going to do it now, obviously, mm-hmm. but this is definitely something we will do at some point. Again, it's a huge and it's hard. As we just said, it's hard to make generalization, but there's definitely our trends emerging, and that's something we should definitely talk about at some point.
Well, I know George, by the way, and he I don't think he writes plays anymore, but I've seen a couple of them, and I thought that they were very good and quite interesting, so we'll get back to this.
But it's also threaded through our discussions, I think. It's sort of one of the underlying sort of continuing dramas in this little studio is the question of where plays are going and how are they supported mm-hmm. and what
how does the food chain work.
Joe Hederle wrote to point out that you guys kept interrupting me.
Did we? Huh?
And I want to make clear that I personally didn't feel that way, and I did not. Don't. Just to be clear, we have very spirited conversations. That's kind of the way it works. We interrupt each other constantly. or not. I mean, sometimes it happens, sometimes not. There's a lot of like gesticulation and hand signals going on. So
no violence.
Just you know, just to reassure everybody that I have not I am satisfied.
Yeah, he wrote about the podcast that we had called Uncomfortable Conversations, mm-hmm. which was the one about problems and scandals overtaking artistic
right.
directors. And I when we got that email, the first thing I did was ask you, Elizabeth, is this true? And, then,
right.
And you said no. And so I went back, as all of you can do, and listened to the segment that he was mentioning. I didn't hear what he was talking about, but it occurred to me that maybe this was an example of the difference between what it's like to be in a conversation, actually looking at the other two people mm-hmm. in the room, and only hearing the soundtrack of that mm-hmm. conversation. I mean, we're constantly passing these nonverbal cues and signals. I want to go next. I've got one.
You know, it's like those scripts where they indicate, you know, overlap.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's like they're incredibly hard to read, actually. So
yeah, and the best part of every product is when one of us gets up and stands on the table and starts jumping up and down. That's always a highlight.
The best.
Well, let me
best.
Take off my shoe here. Well, I don't. Okay. I trust that we all get our licks in
right.
and that we're not standing on each other's heads too much.
Okay. And then next we have Rosalind Farrell. Okay. That's another one. I'm not sure. I'm going to bring it up, but that's something we could talk about maybe at some, or unless we can do it kind of fast. Rosalind Farrell asked how we became critics. And there's a special note for Terry, which is harder, playwright or critic? I don't know if we can deal with this in a short time.
You know, I can answer that part of it quickly. They're just not the same thing. I mean, when you're a critic, you go see a show and then you go write about it and then you're done. And when you write a play, you write it and it takes X amount of time, but then you spend a year or two revising it and then you go through hoops. And I mean, the experiences are related, but so dissimilar that I just couldn't say which was harder. And I don't enjoy one more than the other. They're both fun for me.
I recently found, so I don't know how I became a critic, but I can date it because mm-hmm. I was visiting my mother last year and I found some old notebooks that I was where I was reviewing, put that in quotes, air quotes, reviewing movies I would see on TV when I was 12 or 13.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And there were notes like, this is a real one. Death in Venice. I do not understand why this movie is so popular.
Oh, that's wonderful. Your childhood vocation was to be a critic.
Death in Venice. Like what? 12-year-old? Anyway, that was just pretty nutty. So I would say
I want to know why they were letting you watch that.
That's France for you.
And I can relate that my transformation from reporter to critic literally was overnight. I was a reporter at the New York Times. I was asked if I was interested in becoming a critic. I said no. They said, well, go out and do a couple of sample reviews. I did. I came back. They said, you know what? They're pretty good. Why don't you be the second string critic for the New York Times? That is how it happened.
It's kind of like was that for me with the journal.
Yeah. I don't know if it was a natural progression, but it was the progression.
I mean, I'd been a critic, obviously, but I had never been a working drama critic. And the journal came to me and said, we would like to have a drama critic. We'd like to have somebody who's not a specialist. That's you. Why don't you try this? And I said, well, all right. And so I looked at the calendar, and the first thing I wanted to see was a play by David Ives, Polish Joke. So I covered it, and then I did a couple more reviews, and I realized within maybe 3 weeks that in the middle of life, something overwhelming had happened to me, that I really liked being a drama critic specifically, and that I wanted to do more of it. I mean, outside of purely personal things, that's probably the most important thing that's happened to me.
I'm tearing up.
Quarter century.
It was the discovery
of a vocation, and I never doubted it.
I'm sorry, but Rosalind had a two-part question.
Oh, okay.
Which I think we'll have a very quick answer to that one. She also regrets that ticket prices are too high.
Oh, God.
Well, of course. And wonders if they'll ever be affordable for the average person again. And I'm going to tell you right now that the answer is no.
Not on Broadway, no.
No. It's not going to happen.
It's not a point of no return. Either, really. Yeah. I mean, yeah. You know what it is? I do have friends who know how to play the game.
Yes, it is possible.
It is possible, but you've got to almost make it a second career to figure out how to take mm-hmm. advantage of all the ways you can get cheaper tickets right. for young people and for older people. Mm-hmm. If you're 45, forget it. But yeah. if you're over 65 or you're under 30, mm-hmm. there are tremendous ways to do that. I mean, the yes. question is if they'll ever figure out right. a system for making those 30-year-olds to 65-year-olds more okay. Easily attainable.
But the good news is for all of you who do not live in New York.
Say the good news.
The good news is there are better alternatives where you live. If you yes. live anywhere near most major cities, there's all kinds of affordable, high-quality, exciting theater. All you have to do is go and look for mm-hmm. it.
Right.
You're
right.
And if you're in, okay, leading us right to the next one, Megan Randolph. Now, she is in Madison, Wisconsin.
Close to Spring Break.
And
yeah.
she's run and or founded small companies. And one of the things she
I
was
I remember writing, one of the Music Theater of Madison.
Yes. And yes, that's exactly it. And she was reacting to the segment about the kind of not again syndrome mm-hmm. where we see the same place over and over again. And she was pointing out that when you're a small company, you do have to get people in, and sometimes it does. That is what it takes. But she also points out that, I'm going to quote her there. She said, let's encourage people to check out theaters that aren't major. And she thinks that if you're a smaller theater, I hope I'm not completely distorting what she's saying, because it was a long letter, so I can't really read the whole thing. She said, let's create a culture of journalism that doesn't encourage people to see something as major or minor in terms of its size, but can evaluate community impact and artistic value on an individual basis with that comparison. Mm. Because I feel the small organizations have a finger on the pulse of what you're talking about. Daring, interesting, exciting new works where you won't sit down and feel like you're sitting through the same thing again, but instead wondering what you'll see. That should be the experience of going to the theater. The same sense of wonder and intrigue at going to a brand new movie, reading a new book, hearing a new song. We don't have that mentality about live theater. That is, yes, of course.
I mean, right on the money.
We also, there's some song that I could listen to like 100 times, but I also look for new songs, and it's true that, but at the same time, I think price does come into play here.
And we're also writing for different audiences all at the same time, because we're
right.
Everybody is seeing theater in a sense at their own speed. Some people are consuming massive amounts of theater a year and become mm-hmm. experts on all kinds, and some people go three times a year, and then some people just patronize one company. I mean, and
right.
so you have to take all these things into account when you're choosing and writing what shows to cover and how to cover them. And we're all under similar pressures in terms of how large an audience of readership there is for any one review. That's another
right.
factor that comes into play. So it's sometimes hard to get to that sort of granular level with what's going on in those smaller companies.
Well, all this said, let me offer as a possible rule of thumb. If you're only going to plays in theaters of 500 seats or larger, you're doing something wrong.
Right. I think that's true.
Critics, audiences,
right.
everybody.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
That's
the
true.
The smaller the house, the more the chances are being taken. Good chances, crazy chances, but chances. Remember that. And also, the smaller the house, at least as far as I'm concerned, the more exciting the experience itself.
Yes.
And the more likely you're going to be spit on at some point.
Yes, yes.
Or
unless
worse.
Unless you're sitting in the front row. They don't usually put
and
us
finally,
there.
Kate Paolo just saw Chess at the Kennedy Center. And it's one of her favorite musicals.
Uh-oh.
But she agrees
Never
there's problems
it.
With it.
Yes.
And she was wondering, basically, she found herself thinking of ways to fix the book of Chess.
Right.
Great people have tried to
yes,
fix the book
many.
For Chess. Many have tried. Many have failed. Actually, all of them have failed.
Like
many.
Like
everybody
yeah.
has
yeah.
failed.
Yeah. So what, she's got
and,
her own
and
book.
So she was, no, but she was kind of wondering, okay, so how do you direct a show? Like, okay, that's another huge question.
She's asking,
like,
how does someone direct a show that's
like where,
a problem?
What are the ideas? Like, would you take Chess? It's such a huge question. I think we should save that one for
She's asking that of directors, though.
Well, yeah, I suppose. Yeah. Or, like, I guess she found herself watching chess and thinking, how would I fix that?
I see.
Who hasn't thought that watching chess? Right.
I'll tell you what. I happen to have just written a whole essay about this specific question.
Oh, fantastic.
Which is, naturally.
Which is, how do you direct a show, having just done that? And the shortest possible answer is you start by asking yourself what the show is about. Because every subsequent decision flows from the answer to that question. And it's not always
obvious. But she's asking, what does one do with a flawed piece, something that clearly has not worked 100% ever, and you're now coming into that, you know, what can you do to change the alchemy? I think that's what she's saying.
But you're asking the same question, which is, what is this show really? Who's it about? What's the arc? What's going on?
Listen,
why
it goes
is it not
right
working?
Back. It goes right back to what we're talking about with Children of a Lesser God.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what do you do? And you could see that Kenny Leon in that production was trying in some way. He was introducing Stevie Wonder music, I think, at the beginning, which made no sense. But he was, he was looking at it and clearly trying to make it relatable for an audience in a way that he probably detected it wasn't totally going to do on its own. So, you know, these things, they try and fail. I'd say probably more often they fail than they succeed.
Right.
And with chess, you know, in spite of this gorgeous score, you're going to always fail, I think, to find the way to make it.
This is like, this is my hope that one day it will work, but my hope is shrinking.
You know, the Irish Rep just announced this summer that it's going to revive on A Clear Day You Can See Forever.
Right, with Melissa Errico.
It's another one of those famous.
With who?
Melissa Errico.
Oh, I love Melissa
right.
Errico.
One of those famous problem musicals.
I think that's her. I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Yeah. And the last time it was done on Broadway, they rewrote the book completely, and it was one of the great disasters of our time. Totally.
But it did give us Jesse Mueller.
It gave us Jesse Mueller, right. And it had no other virtues.
I love David Turner, but it was a tough role.
I think if you really feel that you have to totally rewrite the book, you may ought to be thinking about doing a different show.
Okay, yeah. Well, we're going to move on to our final moments of episode 11, and our usual wrap-up is with a show that each of us has seen recently and either had a wonderful or miserable experience or somewhere in between. Elizabeth, you want to lead us off?
Yeah, I'm actually going to do two, but it's a twofer, and I think they work well together.
Right.
And also, I saw them back-to-back.
Okay.
I saw the Broadway revivals of Carousel and My Fair Lady. Now, these two shows have been paired together in previews as the quote-unquote problematic musicals because of the subject matter. And I think these productions, which I both loved.
Both Broadway, by the way.
Yes, both on Broadway, really find ways. Well, first of all, for Carousel, I'm going to be daring there, but I don't think the material is problematic. The material is complex and complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And the material, the show is not problematic because the show does not say that Billy Bigelow, the show does not ask you to sympathize with this.
Oh,
with
Elizabeth, Billy. You have just said something very important.
Don't interrupt her.
That there is a difference between problematic and complex.
And the problem, it's a show for adult who can think. It's a show for adult who can tell the difference between a character who's complicated and is a bad person without asking you. I mean, the show does not ask you to say it's a great guy. It's not that at all. Does not glorify Billy. And the show, and this production in particular, makes very clear why she stays with them. And why some women, this is a choice that some women make. It is not a good choice. The show does not set a good choice. It's a terrible choice. It's a terrible choice she makes, but she makes it. And it's very clear in the show why this happens. Okay, and then My Fair Lady.
We all have a lot of thoughts about this, but we'll have to hold off.
Yeah. My Fair Lady, which is a completely gorgeous production, with, at the end, I think the end, which I don't want to spoil in case you come and see it.
Yeah, let's be careful about that.
But really solves the issue of that many people have with the end of My Fair Lady. It solves it beautifully without changing at all the book.
Not only that, it's actually closer to Pygmalion.
Right.
Right.
So
my problem with that, of course, is that My Fair Lady is not Pygmalion. And I think that this production is the end of this production is profoundly untrue to the show that we actually have in front of us and to what the music is telling us about how this show ends. I have a problem interesting. With that.
That's an interesting. I mean, again, we could probably devote a whole segment, and maybe we should down the road, especially maybe after the Tony nomination, since we see where this is all landing.
Yeah, that's a good
idea.
Might
be an interesting.
It's a really good idea.
Terry, you want to tell us about something?
Yeah, I'm going to think small, since I'm the guy who likes to go to small theaters. I mentioned The Irish Rep a moment ago. They are doing a revival of Connor McPherson's The Seafarer from 2006. It was premiered on Broadway in 2007. I saw it there. Then I saw it at Steppenwolf in 2008. This is the third time I have seen this play. And it's very dangerous to say that something is a masterpiece when it's only a decade old. But after these three superior productions, and The Irish Rep staging is just as good as the ones I mentioned, I begin to think that this one's going to last. It is a remarkable play about despair. Despair at Christmas time, despair on Christmas Eve. It is directed by Kieran O'Reilly, the producing director of The Irish Rep. And nominally, it stars Matthew Broderick. But in fact, that is an ensemble cast. Five men who are working together as a single unit in a very small house where you are with I think it's like 150 seats there. That's another way to do immersive theater, just in a small house where you're in the room with them. And I was thrilled, and I'd go back to see it again next week.
Mm. Always what you want to hear about a show, right?
That you could go again, right?
Oh man,
I would have paid to see this one.
Well, I feel I feel similarly about a show I saw at Woolly Mammoth that I originally had seen at Ars Nova in New York, and it was the Ars Nova production of Underground Railroad Game, which I find to be a great play. It's a performance piece, essentially. I'm not going to describe it in too much detail because we don't have time, but it's performed by its creators, Scott Shepherd and Jennifer Kidwell.
Not the Scott Shepherd of the Wooster Group.
No, this is Scott R. Shepherd, I think. Scott R. Shepherd, is that his name? Scott R. Shepherd, I'm correct.
Research department.
Thank you. Thank you, research department. That was really good. Good catch. But it's a wonderful piece about racism in America and also the legacy of slavery, how it lives with us and how we really haven't resolved any of these issues in any way that one could say there's been that horrible word closure. It's still open, an open wound in this country. And I hope that even though it's very daring and raw material at various instances, I hope it gets to be seen not just in Washington, but I hope it goes everywhere in this country.
You know, we're critics. That means we complain a lot, and we've complained a lot in previous episodes about this season and what's wrong with it and Not Again syndrome, and it's all true. But boy, is there a lot of good stuff to see.
Mm.
I mean, just what we've been talking about the last hour or so. Good heavens. There's no shortage of opportunities to go out and see something that's exciting and involving and that might even change your life.
And that we won't interrupt Elizabeth about if she speaks about it at any length she wants. Well, that wraps it up for episode 11. We hope you'll come back with us for episode 12, which we'll be taping shortly.
Probably in about 10 minutes.
Yes, yeah, right. Exactly. Let's wrap it up.
I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli.
I'm Terry Teachout, and you have been listening to Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America, hosted by American Theater Magazine.
Our producer is Kirby Pate. You can follow us on Twitter at Three on the Isle and write to us at threeontheisle@gmail.com, and both of them are spelled out.
Let us know what you think about what you've heard and what you'd like to hear on future podcasts.
Thank you so much for listening. We'll be with you again soon on the Isle.